I'm just really fun. So I've been shuffling. I'll shuffle one more time just so you can see that they are shuffled. Okay. Right. Okay, pick in the chat and we'll see which one gets the most votes. One, two, three. Whichever one gets the most votes, that'll be the one that I choose. Okay, so far the twos are winning. Has everyone voted that's going to vote? If so, the twos have it. Okay, the twos have it. Okay. There it is. It says Legacy of Light. This is another card by Alana Fairchild, or deck, not card. It's this Sacred Rebels Oracle deck. Alana Fairchild's decks are so freaking gorgeous and powerful. So we will see what does this card have for us tonight before we dive in. Okay. The card is Legacy of Light. You are being asked to honor the legacy of light that is your sacred birthright. Take nourishment and support from those that have come before you, your ancestral lines, not only in blood, but also in spirit. Perhaps these are the beings that have inspired and motivated you to live as a sacred rebel from your heart and with belief in yourself. The more you are nourished by this legacy of light from your past, the more you become a bearer of the legacy for those that will be supported by your light in the future. This is a sacred endowment from the great universal source of light to humanity. It is the light of wisdom, creativity, radical courage, love, and respect that is passed down from the heart of each generation to the next. The legacy of light is your spiritual birthright to refine and shine your essence to the world, to be like a sun, radiant and unapologetic of your nature. Ooh, I love that. The Oracle of Legacy of Light comes to you when you need confirmation that a creative choice you are making or have made or will soon make is one that is in alignment with your sacred purpose and spiritual path of healing and growth. The legacy of light cannot be ignored without some detriment to your sense of well-being. If you were asking about a particular question and drew this card, then part of the answer to your question is that the issue at hand is one of utmost importance to your spiritual growth, even if it seems like a relatively insignificant question. The energy around this matter is relevant to your sacred birthright to shine. Perhaps you need to trust more, to know that all is well, no matter what appears to be, and to ask for help and believe that you deserve to receive it. The legacy of light also asks you to call on the unconditionally loving support that exists for you every day. This light will offer you all manner of assistance. To not call upon it is like starving because you believe you have no means to acquire food whilst a feast lays before your eyes, if only you would partake of it. Perhaps you worry that you are asking too much of those who wish to assist you. However, this is a mistaken belief. Those beings of unconditional love who assist us spiritually each day need to shine just as we do. When they are embraced for their purpose to assist with the spiritual growth of humanity through unconditional love, they too become a part of the legacy of light, shining bright with love and helping to illuminate the world. Although you may doubt your goodness at times, and being human does mean there will be some very dark moments on your path, this oracle affirms that you are coming from love with the pure intention to simply live your life and do your best in the circumstances in which you find yourself. You are being asked to avail yourself of the help that is awaiting your request so that your own light can become part of the greater shining legacy of divine brilliance made manifest upon the earth. This oracle is also guiding you to something in your family history or spiritual ancestry that is relevant to you now. Your spiritual ancestry can be recognized through the traditions and cultures you are intrigued by and interested in. They do not have to be the same as the spiritual traditions that you were raised with in this lifetime, although they may be. The influence of your family history and/or spiritual tradition may be encouraging and constructive, but it may also be holding you back. Sometimes we unintentionally absorb the hidden fears of our parents or our religious upbringing, such as the belief that dreams cannot manifest or that we have to compromise to the point of losing what makes us feel truly alive. If you can relate to this or want healing just in case it is happening beyond the level of your conscious awareness, simply complete the healing process below. If you are involved in a group project, this oracle is asking you to stay true to the heart of why you began working together in the first place, and to seek assistance, protection, and guidance from a source that loves all of you unconditionally. You can do this through the healing process below. Finally, if you need a jolt to recognize that you are a creative being entitled to explore your ingenuity, perhaps through taking a class or pursuing your own artistic interests at home, then this oracle brings the particular guidance that yes, this is part of your life path and you are encouraged to take it further. You are also acknowledged through this oracle as having some special and creative healing offering to make to the world in this lifetime. You will leave a legacy of light for the greater good upon this planet, and you will be lovingly supported in many ways by the great creative universal intelligence when you ask for help. If you don't know how to do that, just complete the healing process below. And if you would like to do this, you can say it in your heart or out loud. Through unconditional love, I am open to receiving the support, guidance, protection, and assistance that I need to manifest the legacy of light that shines through me now. I release any conscious or unconscious attachment to beliefs or relationship patterns that hold me back from fully shining my light in the world. I ask that my creative journey be aligned with my spiritual path and blessed for the greatest good. So be it. Place your hands in prayer at your heart and close your eyes. Bow your head to your hands and imagine, sense, or perceive that a beautiful golden light pours down from the center of the universe into the top of your head. It then flows slowly down through your head and into your heart, all the way down through your body and out through the soles of your feet. When you are ready, simply open your eyes. You have completed your healing process. That was fun. Okay, super interesting. The calling and support part. Who has trouble calling in support or asking for help? Okay, good. Good, Mel, I'm glad that really resonated for you. That's wonderful. Okay, so fun. So tonight we're going to be talking about triggers. Oh, people are still coming on. Okay. Tonight we're going to be talking about overcoming triggers. So before we start, I would like to play this song, and I would like for us to just have a short, I don't know, you could call it meditation, you could call it just grounding into the space, you could call it breathing, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, just to kind of like get us set in what we're doing tonight and also calm any nerves that may be present consciously or unconsciously. So I will share my sound, we will start that, and then we will get started with tonight's workshop. Everyone hear that? Okay, great. So just connecting with the breath. And let everything from your day just melt away. You have permission to release everything else from your awareness except for being present here and now. The voice in your head is objecting to this. You can imagine putting a pin in that thing that you're letting go for now and just reassuring that part of you that you're going to come back to it. You're not going to forget about it. Allow the breath to become like a wave flowing through your body and through your nose, expanding your chest, your belly, your pelvic floor, all the way into the arches of your feet. And as you exhale, everything contracts. Inhaling through the nose, expanding the chest, expanding the belly, the pelvic floor, into the arches of the feet, and releasing, feeling everything contract. your body is holding tension anywhere, and just bring your awareness to that part of your body. And ask your body if it would be okay to release that. As we're doing this, just allow it to happen. It's okay, it's safe. Maybe your body just feels relief to have a moment to pause like this. Stretching, swaying, any kind of movement that your body wants to make, just allowing your body to make those movements. Thank you. fingers and toes and come back. Hopefully you're feeling a bit more grounded if you weren't feeling grounded before. Maybe it felt good to just breathe for a few minutes. Okay. So again, welcome. Good, Courtney. I'm so glad that was perfect for you. Welcome again. Tonight's workshop is called Untriggered. We're going to be talking about facing and overcoming triggers. And I would totally expect that this might feel sensitive, pokey, squirmy. And that's okay. So however you feel about it, it's fine if you feel that way. You may even get triggered by some of the things I say. And if so, that is perfect because it gives us an opportunity to work through it in real time and you don't have to do it by yourself. So we are going to get started. Again, if you can turn your camera on, I love to see your faces. If not, that's totally fine. David will be in the chat if you have any questions related to a technical issue, a link that you want, something like that. I will not be following the chat. I'm going to close it now, actually. I'll be looking at my second screen and teaching from slides. And if you want to just be present and not take notes, you get the slides as part of the replay. So you can just be here. All right. Here we go. Okay. Everyone can see my screen. Yes. Okay. Wonderful. So welcome to Untriggered. This is our second workshop out of six. So each time I'll tell you a little bit more about me. So this time I will tell you that I was raised in Texas on a horse ranch. My parents raised and bred quarter horses and then paint horses. And I grew up riding and helping birth the bulls and spending the night in the barn when the mares were in labor and all that kind of stuff. It was pretty special. Today, though, I live 1,200 miles north of where I grew up in northeastern Minnesota. We have a little homestead of 5 acres and we utterly love it here. I need to change my chicken count. We have 15 chickens now, not just 10. If you guys have seen my stories lately, I've been posting our little baby chicks. They got moved out to the chicken coop today in a little brooding area in the chicken coop. So they're not in the basement anymore. I love living in the woods because I can forage for food and plant medicines. And we also have a pretty, I would say, sizable garden. It's more than I can handle. So it's not as big as some, but it's enough for me. And before I did the work that I do today, I was a food blogger. You may have heard of my website. It was called All the Nourishing Things. It was kind of big in the like health and wellness food blogger space on the internet. But I sold the food blog back in 2021, right as I was getting started in the business that I have now. It was actually a pretty cool story. So in March of 2020, I was like a year after my dark night of the soul, and I just didn't feel like my heart was super in my food blog anymore. And I was just kind of like, okay, that was fun, but it doesn't feel like that's what I was like put on this planet to do, is like writing recipes and taking photos of food. Not that that's bad. I felt after what I'd been through, it just felt like there was something more for me. And so I remember holding my hands up to the universe, and I remember being like, okay, universe, if the right buyer were to come along, I would totally sell this. Like, I just detached from it. And I didn't tell another person except for David. I never advertised it. I never told any of my food blogger friends, like nothing. A year later, I woke up to an email one morning from a person I didn't recognize. And they were like, we really love your website and we'd like to buy it. Would you be open to selling it? And I was like, oh my gosh, is this for real? Like, really? And I looked into them. We scheduled a Zoom call with them. It was an organic food company and they wanted my website because they wanted the traffic that I was getting. I was getting about 2 million hits from Google searches per year to my website. So they wanted the traffic. And I had a number in my head, had the number in my head for the whole year. They were like, what would you like for it? I told them the number, and I was just like, if they can't pay that number, then I'm out. I'm not doing it. They offered like $2,500 less than the number, and I stood my ground and I was like, nope, this is what I'm willing to sell it for. If you guys can't meet me, that's fine. Like, I'm not in a hurry to sell it. So, and they were like, nope, we'll meet it. And they paid cash for it. And the exact week that we closed on the sale of the food blog, David got laid off from his job. It was like the timing could not have been like more perfect. Well, he didn't have any income coming in and I didn't have any income coming in. We had this full cushion that got us through that time, and it was just amazing, and it allowed us to create what you see today. So, that's my fun story about that. Okay, so the next workshop in this series is the third workshop. It's called Overcoming Health Anxiety. Even if you don't have health anxiety specifically, if you have any kind of anxiety, the information in this third workshop will pertain to that. It is on Wednesday, so 3 weeks from today, Wednesday, May 29th at 5 Central. And then we've made a little change to the group coaching call. Instead of being on Tuesday, June 4th, it's going to be on Monday, June 3rd. And that's because I have to catch a flight on the 4th, so I won't be able to show up and hold a group call that day. So if you've already marked your calendar with the Tuesday date, please change it to the Monday date, because that's the new date for that. So the workshop about health anxiety is about feeling your body and its sensations without panicking, without doom googling, repatterning your relationship with your body so that you're orienting to pleasure instead of pain, or pleasure and pain. Like, I don't expect you to like totally get rid of pain just because you're orienting to pleasure, but we most often orient to our bodies from a place of pain and what's wrong versus what feels good. So I'm going to be talking a lot about reorienting to pleasure and also finding safety within yourself, even if you do have like an actual medical issue that you need help with. So it's a really, really good one. It's one of my favorites of the series. So tonight we're going to talk about triggers and your brain and nervous system. So here we go. So a trigger is a present moment resurrection of past trauma or emotional experiences. It's when something happens in the present moment that pokes that past button and is like, whoa, something big is happening, but it's actually from the past, not in the present. So when you're faced with a present moment, situation or person that elicits an uncomfortable emotional response that is similar to what you've experienced in a past trauma, you are triggered. So although the trauma isn't happening in the present, the body and also the ego, the story in your head, are reacting as if what is happening in the present moment is just as bad, just as severe as what happened in the past. So, triggers in complex PTSD are also called flashbacks or emotional flashbacks. So I'll use those terms interchangeably. Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, in his book, The Body Keeps the Score, says about triggers, many people may not be aware of the connection between their crazy feelings and reactions and the traumatic events that are being replayed. They have no idea why they respond to some minor irritation as if they were about to be annihilated. Has anyone ever responded to a minor irritation as if like the worst thing in the world is happening? Okay, a few people. Great. So whether it's a present moment resurrection of past trauma or a normal empathetic response to disturbing things, your nervous system is dysregulated. And from that place of dysregulation, unhealthy coping mechanisms, avoidance, unconscious reactions occur. So there is a difference between a trigger in terms of like when you are deeply disturbed by a disturbing thing. For example, like the Sarah McLachlan videos that show dogs in shelters that are like starving and their hair is all matted together. Like, I can't handle that kind of stuff. That's not because I've had a past experience with like a neglected, abused animal. It's because I'm a really empathetic person and I'm disturbed by something that's disturbing. And that's a really natural empathetic human response. But it's not the type of trigger that I'm talking about tonight. The type of trigger I'm talking about tonight is the present moment resurrection of past emotional experiences. So Pete Walker, in his book Complex PTSD, defines a trigger as an external or internal stimulus that activates us into an emotional flashback. This often occurs outside the boundaries of normal consciousness. And also back to the body keeps the score. The bottom line is that the threat perception system of the brain has changed and people's physical reactions are dictated by the imprint of the past. So a trigger can also be normal but intense feelings of disgust, disturbance, fear, and helplessness in response to disturbing things, like I mentioned, like images of graphic violence or animal cruelty, human trafficking, et cetera, deeply disturbing things. You're a normal human if you are disturbed by deeply disturbing things. But those are not the same kind of triggers that are often more subtle and nebulous that are especially involved with complex PTSD. A trigger could also be like for a person who has PTSD, for example, if they were in like a bombing or a shooting or something, 4th of July happens, they hear fireworks, their body responds in the same way. That's also a trigger, but that's not a complex PTSD trigger. Complex PTSD triggers are much more subtle. They're much more nebulous. They're very difficult sometimes to kind of like put your finger on and be like, oh, this is why I was triggered. The way that someone who's been in a war gets triggered by the sound of fireworks, they know exactly why they're triggered. Often with complex PTSD, we don't know exactly why we're triggered because whatever happened to us is like outside of our conscious memory, outside of our conscious awareness. We haven't connected the dots yet, et cetera. So people who are triggered or in an emotional flashback often organize their lives around trying to protect against them. If elements of the trauma are replayed again and again, the accompanying stress hormones engrave those memories more deeply into the mind. Not being able to deeply take in what is going on around them makes it impossible to feel fully alive. It becomes harder to feel the joys and aggravations of ordinary life, harder to concentrate on the tasks at hand. Not being fully alive in the present keeps them more firmly imprisoned in the past. So triggers just make it really hard for us to be totally present in our lives, especially the complex triggers from complex PTSD. Your brain and your nervous system do not behave differently depending on whether the threat is real, where you're in actual danger, or if the threat is perceived, which means it's not a real threat, it's a perceived threat, and you're most often triggered. So when you are triggered, you're having a present moment nervous system response to a past event, situation, person, or feeling. But your brain and your nervous system don't know the difference between the two. They're both behaving as if the threat is happening in real time. So until that trigger is faced, and we have to have curious awareness to do this, we will continue to live in fear of being triggered, or we will be triggered a lot. And this most often looks like avoidance. So we start learning to avoid people, places, situations, social media accounts, et cetera, because they poke those buttons that bring up those overwhelming past emotions and sensations. And sometimes you may not even be aware that you're triggered. You just know that you feel extremely uncomfortable, but maybe you don't know why. And again, I'm not talking about being deeply disturbed by a disturbing thing. I'm talking about like the way that I trigger people on social media all the time. Like they haven't looked in that mirror yet, or they haven't been curious enough about why they're responding the way they're responding. So it then becomes my fault for posting what I post instead of them taking what their reaction is to what I post and being curious about that. Like, oh, isn't that interesting that I'm having such a big reaction to the things this lady's saying on social media? And sometimes we're not avoiding the trigger itself. Sometimes what we're in avoidance of is taking responsibility for the trigger. And that's a really, that can be really pokey for a lot of people. So sometimes our triggers are misdirected fight response. And that looks like blaming, shaming, gaslighting, and manipulating others so that you don't have to feel the discomfort of your triggers or take responsibility for yourself. That sort of like throwing it back at the other person is also another means of avoidance, but instead of it being like a dissociative type of avoidance or a flight running away type of avoidance, it's a fight avoidance where you're taking it and you're turning it back on them and making it their fault. They're the problem. However, it's not a failure or an avoidance of triggers if you feel deeply disturbed by disturbing things. So I just want to make sure we're clear on the difference. We're naturally empathetic and we are wired to feel others' pain, whether they're humans or not humans. These are not the types of triggers that we want to get over. We don't want to desensitize ourselves to like violence against the planet or violence against children or animals, because that would be an attempt to transcend our humanity, which is not only impossible, but it's not what we want to do anyway. So you can absolutely work through facing your triggers on your own or with a trusted person. You may need professional help to work through some big triggers or some really sticky triggers, especially if they affect like your most intimate relationships, or if they're affecting how you're raising your kids, for example. You may need extra help for that. And it is smart to proceed carefully because facing our triggers requires some resources in our nervous systems. It requires us to be resourced within ourselves, and to be willing to get activated so that we actually have that process of working through it in real time. But we don't want to proceed too carefully because sometimes too carefully also leads to avoidance. The whole "I'm not ready yet, I'm not ready yet, I'm not ready yet, I can't do it yet, not yet, not yet, not yet" becomes this sort of like constant excuse that we use to stay in avoidance. So here's a neutral statement. When you are triggered, your nervous system is dysregulated, and your triggers matter. They really do matter. It matters what triggers you, but whether you face them or not is entirely up to you. And I say that that's a neutral statement because I know that can be triggering for me to say whether you face them or not is entirely up to you. And literally anything has the potential to be a trigger. Joking, but true, including the all caps on the slide. A couple years ago, I don't know if any of you were following me on Instagram at the time, but a couple years ago, I was making slides for my posts where certain words that I wanted to emphasize, or certain words that like I didn't want everything to be all lowercase. I wanted some things to kind of stick out. And so I would use capital letters. And I had multiple people in my comments that were like, "This post is so triggering to me because of the capital letters. It's like you're yelling at me." And I was like, "Oh my gosh." I guess these people had spent a lot of time online, and so like I didn't grow up in the forums and stuff. So like I guess in internet world, whenever you use all caps, it means that you're yelling or whatever, but like I wasn't using it in that way, and it was pretty obvious that I wasn't using it in that way. But everybody's filtering stuff through their own perception, right? So like if you have that programming that all caps equals yelling, and then you see my content that's about healing and nervous system regulation, I can see why people would be like, "Well, how am I supposed to feel regulated by this if you're yelling at me?" But like that's not what I was doing. It was a really, really interesting time in the internet. Like this is also during cancel culture and stuff like that, when everybody was just fucking sensitive to everything. What a time, right? What a time that was. So our triggers can be external and internal. Examples of external triggers are people, places, things, events, facial expressions, certain styles of communication that remind us of our original trauma, visiting your parents, having an anniversary of a trauma, hearing someone using a shaming tone when they're speaking to you or someone you love, someone looking at you in a certain way. Public speaking, authority figures are all external triggers. And then internal triggers can be things like physical pain or other sensations that are alarming to you, making a mistake or not being perfect, especially if you have like a lot of perfectionist tendencies, then not being perfect becomes a trigger. Negative noticing, so like everything you notice, there's something negative about it. The glass is always half empty instead of half full. When you perseverate about what has or what could go wrong, so if you're catastrophizing, if you're perseverating that even though danger isn't present, that there's something you're missing or something like that. And basically, your internal critic being just kind of off the rails, just like that voice in your head that's always beating you up. And certainly, that can be amplified when other people are mirroring back to you something uncomfortable, and that inner critic can still come in and just be in your ear and be like very, very triggering and can make you shut down or fly off the handle or want to run away or any kind of response. So if you don't see your specific trigger listed, that's okay. And it can still be a trigger because literally anything can be a trigger. And like we don't need to compare, like, "Oh, I'm triggered by small things and they're triggered by big things." Like there's no such thing, just like there's no such thing as big T or little T trauma. No use in comparing. If it's a trigger for you, it's important, period. So triggers can feel scary, overwhelming, even like we're dying. It's very uncomfortable to feel triggered. And also, triggers are pathways to consciousness if we allow them to be. So triggers are an invitation to deeper self-awareness and healing. That's why when we avoid them, we're actually doing ourselves a disservice. Triggers are opportunities to make conscious choices that support the reality and outcome we desire. Triggers are an open doorway to freedom if we're willing to walk through it, which can be really uncomfortable. Triggers are invitations to self-responsibility and agency. Triggers prove that we can feel or experience.
Arlo.
Whoa.
Arlo sat on it. Sorry, baby.
Oh, somebody wasn't muted. triggers prove that we can feel or experience hard, uncomfortable things and still be okay. And triggers show us where our boundaries have been crossed or where we need to set a boundary. So triggers are actually really valuable information, which is why we don't want to avoid them altogether. So complex PTSD triggers, also known as emotional flashbacks, can be present with both overt, obvious cues and subtle cues that many people don't recognize as a trigger. Sometimes these flashbacks can only last a few moments and they pass with only a slight amount of uneasiness. And sometimes flashbacks can last days or weeks or even months. And you know that you're in a flashback if you're like in that spiral of overthinking, catastrophizing, negative noticing, ruminating. Like, this is why it's so subtle and nebulous with complex PTSD, because for a lot of you, being in that ruminating, overthinking, thought looping place might be your day-to-day existence. Like, that might be normal for you, but that's actually, you're in a trigger. You're in an emotional flashback constantly. So it's really, really important to become aware of that and start being curious about it and noticing it and challenging it. Otherwise, that's just proof that you're living in that dysregulated state all the time. So I would like to share about a prolonged and repeated trigger for me that I had to intensely work through for about a year. And it started in the fall of 2022. So in the fall of 2022, my mom, who I had not seen for 2 years because of COVID, so I hadn't seen her since 2020, she was having back surgery. And she asked me if I would come down to Texas and take care of her after her back surgery, which of course I agreed to do. And I was with her for 2 weeks. She had really major back surgery, some fusions in her spine. She had a cyst cut off her spine, just a really, really big deal. And I went down there knowing like, okay, she's coming out of anesthesia. She's going to be on pain meds. She's going to be loopy. She's probably going to be really emotional. She's going to be really tired. Have grace, have patience. Like, I was preparing myself for like, however she would be. What I was not prepared for, though, was that in my mom's state, which, you know, was not her fault, she displayed some old behaviors, like being passive aggressive towards me and giving me the silent treatment that she used to do all the time when I was a young child. And she was doing these things while I was trying to take care of her after her surgery. And at that time, it was impossible for me to continue to have like grace and patience when she was behaving in this way. Even though I know she was in pain, even though I know she was on pain meds, even though I know she was hurting and had come out of anesthesia and all of that, like I knew all of that in my head, but my body, when my mom would be passive aggressive with me or would give me the silent treatment during that time, was like, ugh. Like it was so awful. And it felt exactly the way it felt whenever I was a little girl and she would do the same thing. So my core wound of my life is emotional neglect and abandonment from my mother. I only know of one time that my mom like actually physically abandoned me. It was when I was 3 years old and I heard this from my uncle, and my uncle said that my mom and him and me were in the car. My mom was driving and I was like throwing a fit or having a meltdown or like something. And my mom pulled the car over, took me out of the car, left me on the side of the road and drove off. And I don't know how long she was gone. It may have only been a few seconds. She may have circled the block and come back. Like, I have no idea how long it was, but my uncle said, I was telling your mom, like, you can't do that. You have to go back and get her. And she eventually did go back and get me, obviously. But then as I grew up, although I don't have any other memories of her like physically abandoning me that way, what was much more harmful to me was the way that she emotionally abandoned me like all the time. So it was a really normal childhood occurrence for me to like get off the bus after school. We were trained to get off the bus and come in the house. And as soon as we came in the house, to ask my mom, is there anything we can do to help? So she would typically be in the kitchen, like making dinner or something. And before we did homework, before we played, before we did anything, we had to come in and ask, is there anything we can do to help? And so many times, I would say over 50% of the time, I would come home and be like, hi, mom, is there anything I can do to help? And she would have her back turned to me. She would not turn around and acknowledge that I was there. And she would have this flat tone and just be like, no, it's fine. And my little spidey senses and my sensitive body would be like, okay, something's not fine. Like, because what a child wants and needs when they get home from school is for mom to turn around and have her arms open and be like, you're home. I'm so happy to see you. How was your day? Tell me everything, right? Like, that's what we need. I didn't get that. Instead, I got this flat, cold, numb, like nothing from her. So the anxiety would rise up in my body. And on the inside, I'm like, everything is not fine. Why isn't she turning around? Why isn't she hugging me? Why isn't she asking me how my day was? And so then I would pursue and initiate, kind of like leaning in and being like, is everything okay? And again, without talking or without looking at me, without acknowledging me, flat tone, it's fine. And again, like my body is so confused because here my mother, who I trust, is telling me everything is fine, but in my body, everything is not fine. And so that created this dissonance within me where it's like, I don't even know that I can believe my experiences because I'm having this anxiety feeling because you're withdrawn from me, but yet you're telling me everything's fine, but it doesn't feel fine. And so then I would like initiate and try to reestablish that connection with her. And when talking to her didn't work, then I would start like trying to figure out other ways to earn her attention and her love and her connection back. So I would start cleaning, or I would like rearrange something decorative and see if she would look at it and notice, or I would pull out a report card with straight A's and be like, what about this? Maybe this will work. And it was really like a throwing spaghetti against the wall to see what worked kind of situation to reestablish this connection with my mom. And that has been my mom's pattern with me for my entire life. So in 2022, whenever I went to see her and help her after this back surgery, and she started having that same flat, cold, no facial expression, no acknowledgement of anything, passive aggressive, silent treatment thing, I lost it. I mean, I fucking lost it. And when I got home from taking care of her, for the first like 10 days or so, I would call her or text her every day. Like, how are you feeling? How was your doctor's appointment? Have you started physical therapy yet? Like, I was trying to stay in touch. And every time her words were still, it's fine. No, whatever. Like very flat, very cold. So I was like, okay, she's clearly, even though she's not directly setting a boundary with me, her words and the way she's speaking is communicating to me that she doesn't want to talk to me. Like that's what I was deducing from that. And so I backed off and I quit talking to her. And I didn't talk to her for a year and a half. And that was her choice, not mine. I was always available on the other end, always. But what I noticed in myself was in the beginning, for probably the first 4 or 5 months, I had this looping sort of like, is it my responsibility to call her? I mean, the phone does work both ways. And if I'm waiting for her to reach out to me, like I could take responsibility for this and reach out myself, but she doesn't seem like she wants to talk to me. So maybe I shouldn't reach out. Maybe I should just like, do you know this sort of looping internal conversation? Okay. And so I decided after looking back at my childhood and noticing my pattern, which was when she withdrew, I initiated. I moved closer. My fight flight response was propelling me towards her. And I noticed that as a pattern. And I do the exact same thing in any other intimate relationship I've had, whether that's a friend or with David, is if they seem withdrawn, my pattern is to be like, is everything okay? What's wrong? Can we talk about it? What did I do? Did I do something wrong? What do we need to do about it? Can we talk about it? Are you sure everything's okay? Like that's my, that very anxious attached pattern is my pattern. So with my mom now, like I'm not contacting her And for the first few months, it was literally like, I would reach for my phone to be like, well, maybe I'll text her. And I'd be like, no, like, well, maybe I'll just call her. No, like I was literally like smacking my hand away because I was like, I am determined not to repeat this pattern. Like this has been a pattern for 40 years of my life. I'm not going to repeat it anymore. She has a responsibility in this too. Even if she was on pain meds, even if she had just had surgery, like there comes a point when someone can no longer tolerate being treated that way. I reached that point and set boundaries with her and she did not like it. So she got worse. Well, lo and behold, with the messiness of my mom out of the situation, that trigger was so active that in my relationship with David and in my relationship with my friend Honor, it started showing up. Like more, I mean, it had always been there, but it had started showing up even more obviously. So when David would be like withdrawn because he was tired or he was having a bad day or something, even if it had nothing to do with me, I would do the same thing. What's wrong? Is everything okay? Did I do something wrong? Are you mad at me? Do we need to talk about it? Are you sure everything's okay? Well, why aren't you talking to me? If everything's okay, you would be talking to me. Same thing with my friend Honor. Is everything okay? Are you mad at me? Is everything like, what do we need to do? So that still that anxious attachment. So it was really, really intense. And the trigger was abandonment. The trigger was emotional abandonment. My perception that I was going to be abandoned based on their communication cues, whether it was the tone of their voice, their body language, their facial expression, them seeming more withdrawn, me misreading their energy or the vibe or whatever, the trigger was abandonment. Because when they felt more withdrawn, it felt in my body exactly like whenever I was a kid in the kitchen with my mom, trying to get her to reconnect with me. One of the things that's really, really common in people with complex PTSD is a sensitivity to the verbal and nonverbal communication cues of others. Anybody have this sensitivity where you can get thrown off by a look, you can get thrown off by a tone of voice, you often misread or misperceive how other people are communicating. And it's because the lens you're seeing through is, oh, they must be mad at me. I must have done something wrong. They must not approve of me in some way. I must have disappointed them for some reason. So in intimate relationship, in emotionally intimate relationships, I tend to be more hypervigilance. So that sensitivity to verbal and non-verbal communication cues is hypervigilance. And in the more emotionally intimate a relationship is, the more hypervigilant I can be. And my unconscious adaptation or my survival pattern that I developed to protect me from abandonment as a child was being able to read people, being able to be so sensitive to subtle cues and changes of their tone of voice, shifts in their posture, shifts in their body language, an eyebrow that might cock up. When I've been really, really triggered, David can confirm this. When I've been really, really triggered, I am even sensitive to the tense of verb that someone is using. Like one time David spoke to me using a past tense verb and I was so triggered. It was during this year. I was so triggered that I was like, why did you use a past tense verb and not a present tense verb? Are you saying you don't feel this way about me anymore because you felt this way about me in the past? Like, what do you mean? Like, that's really how intense it could be that I'm so sensitive to even the tense of a verb. So the pattern, the adaptive survival pattern, was this hypervigilance and then this pursuit, this anxious pursuit. Or I might go into an avoidant pattern as well. I have a disorganized attachment style. So with some people, like with David, I'm very anxious. And then with my friend Honor, I would become avoidant. So the pattern was hypervigilance, that I would perceive that I had disappointed someone or that they disapproved of me based on their tone, facial expression, et cetera. I struggled to stay present and instead would dissociate and collapse if my pursuit of them didn't work. I couldn't speak up for myself, or if I could, I would get really defensive and I would be unable to hear the other person. So it would be a variety of different responses. It wasn't one response every single time because the pattern wasn't my response. The pattern was the hypervigilance, if that makes sense. So depending on the person, depending on the situation, my response might be to get really defensive and like make it their fault, Or my response might be to dissociate, leave my body. Like I can remember having a conflict with my friend Honor once where she like snapped at me about something and I left my body. Like I didn't feel anger. I didn't feel like I needed to leave. I literally left my body and I could like see myself looking down at myself. And inside my head, I was going, say something, Lindsay, you need to say something. You need to set a boundary. She can't talk to you like that. And like, I got red in my chest and red all up my face and I couldn't say anything. So I just got up and went to the bathroom and went and shook and texted David about it and then left. Because I couldn't say something in the moment. And it took me like 2 weeks to be able to come back around and say something to her. So different ways that the pattern showed up, but the pattern was hypervigilance and me trying to either defend myself from being left or abandoning myself by dissociating or people pleasing to avoid being abandoned. So my lived experience of that particular pattern is that there were one of two possible outcomes. The first outcome, based on my mom's emotional abandonment, was they leave. Maybe they don't physically walk out the door, but their loving, nurturing presence and the safety in the relationship is gone. The silent treatment is how I most often experienced this type of emotional abandonment. The second option is I leave myself as an attempt to keep them from leaving me. So I self-abandon by fawning, by people pleasing, by not setting a boundary, by being reactive, or by trying to earn their attention or their love back. Anybody else recognize these patterns in yourself? Okay. So the clues that I was in an emotional flashback, it took me a year of going through this pattern and of being triggered over and over and over again, coming into awareness, being curious about it, the same practice that I teach you guys here is what I was having to do for myself during this time. So here's how I knew I was in an emotional flashback, even though it wasn't like a big, huge trigger. Although sometimes it did feel that way. I would try to avoid the other person. I did this with my friend Honor. I would dread hanging out or I would make up excuses to avoid hanging out with her. That was my avoidant. I would second guess myself in the relationship. I would only notice the negative things or things I perceived as negative. I would dwell on their facial expressions, their body language, and their tone as proof that I was right. Not right meaning like, oh, I'm right about this, but right meaning my hypervigilance was accurate. Does that make sense? I would self-abandon by avoiding the topic, by not speaking up for myself and not setting boundaries. I would be hypervigilant when we were together, looking for any sign that they're upset with me or not upset with me and trying to be perfect. So those two options, either they leave me or I leave myself to avoid being abandoned. Those were the only options when I wasn't aware of my trigger or my ability to feel without fear and regulate my nervous system through that. Those were my only options. Either I leave myself and abandon myself to please them or to fawn for them, or I dissociate and I lose my words, or they're going to leave me. So I have to leave myself before they leave me. But these two options are no longer congruent with who I am today. And this is only possible because of awareness and working through this trigger. I am a more aware, more curious, more embodied person than I've ever been. And my perspective is open to so many more possibilities than either I'm going to get left or I have to leave myself before I get left. Like, I know how to speak up for myself now. I know how to ask for clarification. I know how to consciously communicate. I know how to set boundaries. I didn't always know those things, especially when I was a little girl and my mom was giving me the silent treatment, you know, in the third grade or the fourth grade or something. I didn't have access to any of those options. But because of my healing journey, I now have access to options and possibilities that I didn't have access to before. So this is where I like to talk about neuroplasticity. So neuroplasticity is the brain's ability to rewire itself in response to stress or stimulus. A trigger is definitely a stress and a stimulus. Right? Very stimulating when you're triggered, which is perfect because that's the prime moment to start rewiring your brain when you're stressed out, when you are stimulated by a trigger. We need neuroplasticity to rewire our brains, calm down the limbic brain, and reprogram what's called our reticular activating system. That's a part in your brain I'm going to talk about in a bit. We also need opportunities to be in emotional flashbacks to practice feeling, meeting ourselves with compassion, setting boundaries, and widening our windows of tolerance to stress and discomfort. This is why triggers are not bad, and we don't need to avoid them, because when we allow them, they are literally portals to understanding ourselves more deeply and healing more deeply. So whether we're triggered, hyper-aroused, hypo-aroused, moderately dysregulated, or mildly dysregulated, the goal is to notice, to come into awareness, hopefully quickly, but no shame if not, because it does take practice. Took me over a year to get through this particular trigger. So I know it's not easy. We have to notice what that feels like. What do I feel in my body when I am triggered? What is the sensation? Where does it live? We don't need to try to judge it or fix it or make it go away. We don't need to pick up our phone to escape the dysregulation. It's a thing a lot of people do. A lot of my clients, the second they get dysregulated, they got the phone in their hand. They're dissociating. They're checking out. We have to be present with it, even in the discomfort. Being present in the discomfort is the only way through. Otherwise, we're just staying in avoidance or blaming other people. This means we have to slow down, right? Our fast-paced, rushed, hustling, urgent lifestyles are already contributing to chronic dysregulation. And maybe you have a voice in your head that's like, I don't have time to slow down when I'm dysregulated. I'm dysregulated all the time. I would never do anything but be present with my dysregulation, right? Like maybe that voice is there. If so, that's okay. Just notice it curiously. That's great awareness. Isn't it interesting that you're so dysregulated that you have objection to slowing down and noticing and being present with a trigger, being present with an uncomfortable sensation? Isn't it interesting that you have resistance to slowing down? I wonder why your nervous system is so dysregulated so often, right? Like just being in that sort of chronically fast-paced, busy, you know, never having quiet, never having time outside, never being by yourself, like never turning off the phone and just being present with yourself is dysregulating. Do you not have time to slow down because you're overscheduled, because you work too much, because your kids are in a bunch of extracurricular activities, because your commute is really long? I had a client who was always wanting to be busy. Like she wanted her schedule to be full all the time, and her husband hated it. He was always asking, can we please just have an empty day? Can we please just have one day in a month where we don't do anything, where we don't go visit anybody's parents, where we don't go out with friends, where we don't have something scheduled, where we don't have an appointment, just one day. And it's because she needed that frantic, scheduled, fast-paced lifestyle, because when she had nothing to do, all she was present with was her feelings, and it was insanely uncomfortable for her. And also because slowing down felt boring to her. It felt empty. It felt weird because she was so used to being in that fast-paced energy all the time. Is the way you're living your life stressing out your nervous system? I wonder what shifts you could make so that slowing down is a non-negotiable instead of a luxury. A lot of people don't slow down until they go on vacation, or they go on vacation and then they pack the vacation full of, we have to do everything in 5 days. You know, we have to pack it all in, instead of giving themselves that spaciousness and that slowness to actually like live in a different way. And all of this has to do with facing our triggers, because we need resources in our nervous systems to be present with triggers, to feel our feelings. And if life is so hurried and hectic and fast-paced and overscheduled and busy that we don't have that space, we're going to keep going in circles. So that's what all of this lifestyle has to do with facing triggers. So let's talk about the nervous system and the brain stuff and what it has to do with triggers, because I want to show you what happens in your brain when you're triggered. But first, we'll start with some nervous system review. So if any of you have done my workshop, Nervous System 101, you received it as a freebie whenever you purchased this course. If you haven't watched it yet, I really, really encourage you to watch it. So you'll learn a lot more about your nervous system in that, but we'll just review here. So your autonomic nervous system, that's what I'm talking about when I say nervous system. I'm not talking about your central nervous system. I'm talking about your autonomic nervous system. It is the main communication network between your brain and the rest of your organs. You could think of it as command central in your body. It is an electrical operating system that communicates through felt sensations which tells us how we are in relationship to our internal and external environments. Your autonomic nervous system coordinates your emotions and how intensely you react to stress. And it has three branches: the sympathetic, the parasympathetic, and the social engagement system. When your nervous system is functioning optimally, it controls everything that's automatic in your body. So the word autonomic and the word automatic have the same derivation. So everything that's automatic in your body are things like your heart rate, your respiration, your circulation, your digestion and elimination, your hormone production, your temperature, your sweat, your sleep cycle, your reproduction, detoxification, blood pressure, blood sugar. All of those things are automatically happening in your body. You don't have to do anything to make them happen when your nervous system is functioning in the way it's supposed to. So if you're on a phone, this might be difficult to see. If you're on a bigger screen, it'll be easier. But this is a diagram of the two different branches of the nervous system and what they control. So the parasympathetic and the sympathetic sides of your nervous system are basically like yin and yang. They do equal and opposite things. So like your parasympathetic nervous system constricts your pupils. Your sympathetic nervous system is what dilates your pupils. Your parasympathetic nervous system slows your heart rate down. Your sympathetic nervous system speeds your heart rate up. Your parasympathetic nervous system is commonly called rest and digest. Your sympathetic nervous system is called fight flight. So the parasympathetic branch of the nervous system, that's the one on the left. This is the branch of your nervous system that is responsible for energy conservation. That's also why it's called rest and digest or feed and breed. It's usually labeled good. Like people are like, oh, I want to be in parasympathetic because it's good. In polyvagal theory, it's called the dorsal vagal branch of your nervous system. It's also the brakes of your nervous system. So the reason why it's not always good to be in parasympathetic is because you are in a parasympathetic state if you are collapsed or shut down. So that's why it's not always rest and digest and feed and breed. Okay. It's rest and digest and feed and breed when you're in a safe and social state, not in a dorsal vagal state. Okay, so when your parasympathetic or dorsal vagal is too aroused, meaning the situation or the threat is too much or it's out of control, that is when the nervous system will shut down or you freeze. Mammals, reptiles, birds, and fish have the ability to freeze in the face of overwhelming danger. And freeze occurs on a spectrum. So it can be anything from a full collapse and dissociation to a partial freeze, like an inability to use words or to think clearly or to move. I had a really interesting observation of this in one of our chickens not that long ago. One of our chickens got out of the run, and our dog Lachlan is a bearded collie. He's a herding dog. And so his herding instinct is like uncontrollable. Like if he sees an animal, he is going to chase it and try to get it back where it's supposed to be, like automatically. It is just instinctive for him. So he got an eye on this chicken that had escaped from the run, and he immediately went to chasing it, not chasing it to eat it or chasing it to hurt it, but he's trying to get it back where it's supposed to go because that's what he's bred to do. So he chased this chicken all over, and I was like calling him the whole time. He would not recall, would not obey. He was in the zone of herding this chicken back to where it was supposed to go. The chicken was making all kinds of noise. It was flapping and squawking everywhere. And then as I'm like watching this happen, he gets close to the chicken and all of a sudden it stops moving and it dropped, like dead, like dropped. And I was like, holy shit, did it die? Did it have a heart attack? Like what happened? Did he kill the chicken without even touching it? And then my nervous system knowledge came online and I was like, oh, it froze. Its nervous system realized that fighting the dog wasn't an option. Running away was no longer an option because it was getting tired and the dog is faster than it is. So its only other survival option was to collapse and play dead. And that's what it did. And then after a couple minutes, I mean, it wasn't even minutes. It was like less than a minute. Like I started walking over there and then all of a sudden it like got up and like started walking around again. And like, I saw this, I've never seen it happen in real time. I've seen it in videos and stuff, but I've never seen it happen in real time where prey is being stalked or hunted or whatever by a predator, and they go into that freeze response as their natural instinct to protect themselves because fight and flight didn't work. It was really, really interesting. All right, so the right side is the sympathetic branch of the nervous system. This side is responsible for energy expenditure. It's also called the fight flight branch of the nervous system. We usually label it bad. It's bad to be in fight flight. It doesn't have any fancy words in polyvagal theory. It's just the sympathetic nervous system. And this is the gas of your nervous system. So this is where movement comes from. Okay, so now we're going to talk about primary and secondary states in the nervous system. So this is an example of what's called the polyvagal ladder from Dr. Stephen Porges. He uses the ladder to illustrate the different states of the nervous system and how we move up and down towards safety or through mobilization or immobilization. So I'll start with the primary states first. We have three primary states in our nervous system. We have the social engagement system, that's here at the very top. It's also called a safe and social state. This is the feed and breathe, rest and digest. This is when you're feeling calm, you can communicate clearly, you have open body language, you can collaborate with others, you have access to your creativity. That's all happening up here in this very safe state. The next primary state of the nervous system is our sympathetic or fight flight state. And the next primary state is the state of shutdown. So these are all primary states. And what that means is only one set of neural pathways is active in your brain and body at the time that that state is activated. We also have secondary states or combination states. So when you combine the safety of your social engagement system with the mobilization of your sympathetic nervous system, you get the state of play. Okay, so if you think about children who are running around, playing, laughing, having a really good time, they're feeling totally safe, but they also have a lot of movement. So that's the state of play. If you're an adult, that feels like the workflow state, which is such a fun state to be in, or like a really creative kind of flow state. When you have the movement or mobilization of your sympathetic nervous system combined with the immobilization of your dorsal vagal response, that is the state of freeze. So in my opinion, that's the most difficult state to be in as a human. It's a very difficult state to work with as a practitioner. And it's like the body has the gas and the brakes pressed at the same time. Like that's the state that you're in if you're having a panic attack, is like there's all this energy in your body, but you're not moving, right? Like gas brakes at the same time. Tires are squealing out, but you're not going anywhere. And then the final combined state or secondary state is when you have the safety of your ventral vagal social engagement system combined with your dorsal vagal response. And that is the state of stillness. So if you're a meditator, those are the states of your nervous system that are active when you're meditating to create that state of stillness. You feel really safe, but you're also immobilized. Okay, quote from Deb Dana, who is a polyvagal teacher. She says, polyvagal theory helps us understand that behaviors are manifestations of our internal nervous systems taking actions in the service of survival. People develop these habits based in early adaptive survival responses, and these habits naturally continue into adulthood. When we can recognize how these responses once served a person by helping them tolerate seemingly unbearable circumstances, we are able to cultivate a sense of appreciation for how an individual has survived, adapted, and learned through the difficult experiences and predicaments of their life. This leaves us with the option of a recovery paradigm that creates meaning out of the varied experiences within an individual's body-mind-spirit continuum, rather than putting emphasis on a need to overcome the so-called mental illness. When the autonomic nervous system is balanced, flexible, and resilient, we have a reasonable degree of control over our response to minor frustrations and disappointments, enabling us to calmly assess what's going on. Effective arousal modulation gives us control over our impulses and emotions. As long as we manage to stay calm, we can choose how we want to respond. Individuals with poorly modulated nervous systems are easily thrown off balance, both mentally and physically. Lack of resilience and flexibility in the nervous system not only has negative effects on thinking and feeling, but also on how the body responds to stress. And that's from The Body Keeps the Score. So the goal is not to be at the top of the ladder all the time. It's impossible to be in a safe and social state all the time. The goal is to have a nervous system that can flexibly move up and down the ladder and respond appropriately to a threat. Okay. Every move up and down the ladder is the nervous system's effort to keep us safe and alive. And the more primitive, which is immobilization, so going down towards freeze and shutdown, the more primitive responses are only activated when the more evolved or sympathetic functions fail, which is exactly what happened with the chicken. The chicken was in fight flight until she realized this is not working. And then her immobilized part of her nervous system kicked in, which is a more primitive response than fight flight. So literally anything has the potential to be stored in the body as a trauma response, depending on how your individual nervous system responds. This is why siblings can go through the exact same childhood, have the exact same parents, but when they grow up, they have totally different responses to things. One of them is more resilient. One of them is less resilient. One of them has terrible struggles with their health. The other one is really healthy. It's because one of their nervous systems in childhood was responding to these things differently than the way their sibling was. And because of this, it means literally anything has the potential to be a trigger. So every nervous system on earth functions exactly the same way, but some nervous systems are more resilient and flexible than others for a variety of different reasons. Your nervous system may be intolerant of things and people that other nervous systems can tolerate, and vice versa. So now I want to talk about what happens in the brain when we're triggered, because it's the same thing that happens when a real threat is present. Your brain and your nervous system do not keep linear time. So they don't automatically, logically know, oh, it's not a real threat that's happening right now. I'm just perceiving that it's a threat based on my past experience. Okay. Unless you're like deeply in awareness whenever that happens, which is hard to do. So we're going to start with the amygdala. That is the fear center in your brain. This is where pleasure-based emotional learning comes from. Hint about the next workshop, why I'm going to be talking about reorienting to pleasure. This is also where we learn fearful emotional things. Our amygdala stores memories of stimuli related to fear, and it is where our expression of fear and aggression live. The amygdala is only concerned with survival. It does not care about the quality of our life. Brain scans have shown that the amygdala can increase in size due to trauma, and when you have a larger amygdala, you are more likely to perceive non-threatening things as threatening. Your instinctive memories for survival are stored in the amygdala, meaning you remember what you did last time to survive, so you're more likely to do it again habitually, instinctively, without even thinking. And your amygdala works with your hippocampus, which it is attached to, which is what we're going to talk about next. So your hippocampus creates memory of environment, space, events, and facts. It is where behaviors are linked to emotional responses, and it receives input from the amygdala, which is the fear center, and also from the prefrontal cortex, which is where your thinking and reasoning and logic lie. So your hippocampus is the bridge between your non-logical survival brain and your logical reasoning brain. Your hippocampus is the bridge. Your amygdala and hippocampus work together to declare threat, whether it's real or perceived. Then the hypothalamus sends a message down the brainstem to activate the nervous system to either fight, flee, or immobilize. Your hypothalamus releases corticotropic releasing hormone that signals to your pituitary gland to secrete adrenocorticotropic hormone. So then now your stress hormones are getting involved, your adrenaline and cortisol. And your hypothalamus turns emotions into physical responses. So when you have an increased heart rate in response to fear, your hypothalamus is what is making your heart rate increase as a response to fear. So the amygdala to hippocampus to hypothalamus to nervous system response to stress and stimuli happens in real time with any sort of trauma, any sort of thing that your body has held onto as what you would call trauma. The exact same series of events happens when we're triggered also. Exactly the same. So amygdala, hippocampus, hypothalamus, nervous system, activation, stress hormones, adrenaline, cortisol. Whether it's a real threat or a perceived threat, your limbic system does not know the difference between a real-time trauma and a trigger. And that's why you can act towards a trigger the same way that you would act towards a real-time actual threat. But the prefrontal cortex here, where your reasoning and logic lie, does know the difference. And this is why triggers can be so confusing, because part of you feels like the threat is happening right now, the limbic part of your brain, where the rational, logical part of your brain knows it's not happening right now. And scientifically, when our limbic brain is activated, some or all of the prefrontal cortex goes offline. You may not lose access to all of it, but you will lose access to some of it. This is why it's so difficult to make rational, reasonable decisions when you're in such a deeply dysregulated or triggered state, because part of the thinking part of your brain where you need to make those decisions is partially or totally offline. And you're in the limbic part of your brain that is not capable of making logical, reasonable decisions. Now we're going to talk about your reticular activating system. I mentioned it a few slides back. So this is a part of your brain that receives and filters input from sensory pathways like sight, sound, and touch. It connects the brainstem with your spinal cord, cerebrum, and cerebellum, and it reinforces our deepest subconscious beliefs, especially those about belonging and worth, which tend to form before age 7. Your reticular activating system is where your confirmation bias lives. It is the echo chamber of your mind and beliefs. Your reticular activating system is a sophisticated filter system that allows certain information to your brain and filters out other information. Guess who programmed that filter? You did, and so did the people from your past. The reticular activating system seeks data that validates your beliefs. It screens the world through the parameters you give it, and your beliefs form those parameters. Everything in your life is a reflection of your inner state. If you constantly feel unlovable or you think people don't like you at work, your reticular activating system is going to point out every single piece of evidence that confirms that negative belief all day long. So if you believe it, even if it's a subconscious belief, this part of your brain is scanning everything in your environment, looking for evidence that confirms that that belief is true. So how do we calm down the amygdala whenever it's hijacked during a trigger? There's a tool called havening that I'm going to teach you later. And how do we reprogram our reticular activating system that's hell bent on confirming our subconscious beliefs over and over again? For that, we visualize. Visualization is such a powerful tool to access the subconscious. Our imaginations are such a portal to healing. They're incredible. And visualization is free, as is havening. So remember, your limbic brain, your nervous system, and your reticular activating system do not keep linear time. This is why you can have a physical reaction or sensation to simply imagining something happen. To your brain and your nervous system, that thing is happening in real time. So when you visualize yourself setting a boundary, feeling without fear, shifting a pattern, et cetera, that is happening right now as you visualize it in your body. With consistency and repetition, you can train your reticular activating system to filter differently, less based in the past trauma and more based in the present moment. So hopefully if you feel any shame or anger toward yourself because of your triggers, because of how you've reacted or maybe hurt others when you were triggered, you can be more compassionate with yourself. Your body and brain were simply trying to protect you in the most primitive way. And yes, there may still be consequences to your actions or relationships to repair or accountability to take, et cetera, but there's no shame in it because you have all of this evolutionary biology of your brain that hasn't caught up to the modernization of the society we live in today. It still responds to threats like it's a bear in the woods. Okay, so now we're going to talk about our different responses. So when you're in the red bracket, that's when you're triggered. That's also when you're in a trauma response. That's when your nervous system is trying to protect you using any means necessary. So we're going to talk about each of those states. So now that you know how your brain and nervous system work together to protect you from threats, whether they're real or perceived, you need to know how to recognize the physiological and emotional signs that you're triggered and the trauma responses associated with your reactions. So Pete Walker in Complex PTSD says, recognizing the moment of triggering is even more important than recognizing the trigger itself. So we're going to discuss each trauma response, including how we can meet each response in awareness instead of enacting unconscious reactions on the self and others. So our fight response, this is an activation of the sympathetic branch of the nervous system. The body is preparing to defend itself against danger using physical force if necessary. In a fight response, the emotions that you can feel range from irritability to frustration, anger, rage, aggression, and being totally out of control. The physiological sensations that will happen in your body are your heart rate will increase, Your breathing becomes quick and shallow. Your mouth can dry out. You may get muscle tension, especially your neck, shoulders, legs, low back, butt, pelvic floor for women especially. And your face or your skin can flush red. Some unconscious reactions that we probably all had whenever we've been in a fight response that we didn't meet with awareness are things like slamming our doors, pounding fists, yelling, needing to be right, trying to control other people, mocking, taunting, or shaming other people, actually resorting to violence, you know, doing things like, things like that. Those are unconscious reactions to the physiological and emotional response of your fight response. Now, when your fight response is integrated, it looks like assertiveness, boundaries, self-protection and protection of others, courage, leadership, motivation, and drive. When your fight response is not integrated, that's where we see narcissism, being explosive, controlling, demanding, entitlement, being condescending or intimidating, bullying others, or demanding perfection of self or others. The same energy that it takes to try to control others or control a situation is the exact same energy that it takes to be assertive. The same energy that it takes to be condescending or bullying towards someone or demanding perfection of yourself or someone else is the exact same energy that is required to set boundaries or be motivated and have drive. Exactly the same. It's just, how are you channeling that energy? Because you're either channeling it towards these unintegrated responses or you're channeling it into an integrated response. So here's where your fight response lives on the ladder. What I want you to see is that if you have the ability to access anger, you are actually closer to safety than you are when you are shut down. And this is super, super important for women who often don't allow themselves to have access to their anger because they have stories about being angry is bad. If I'm angry, I'm going to hurt someone. Being angry means I'm not good, or whatever the story is. You are actually closer to safety when you're here than when you're here. So it's really, really important for you to learn how to catch that anger and channel it. Because if you can't channel that anger, what happens when the body is like, well, fight and flight aren't working? Right? We go right back down into that collapse. And then we're like, shit, what is wrong with me? Why can't I figure this out? Because you didn't do anything with that fight. You didn't channel it and hold it. You dropped it. All right, next is our flight response. This is also an activation of the sympathetic branch of the nervous system. And this is how the body prepares to defend itself by running away from danger. So emotions of the flight response are things like panic, anxiety, concern, feeling agitated, or dread. Sensations are exactly the same as with your fight response because this is the same branch of your nervous system. And then our unconscious reactions are things like obsessive thinking, hyperactivity, perfectionism, avoidance, being constantly busy, or worrying. When integrated, our flight response gives us perseverance, healthy disengagement, industriousness, resourcefulness, and knowing how to retreat when conflict would put you in danger or when conflict is a waste of energy. The same energy that is required to do all of those things also happens whenever we're in an unintegrated flight response, which is when we're not meeting that flight response with awareness. So workaholism, micromanaging, being constantly busy, being obsessive compulsive, overthinking, an adrenaline junkie, you're kind of stuck in the on position. You're flitting from one thing to the next, but you're not really landing on anything and completing it, kind of going in circles in your life. So the same energy that's required for those things can be harnessed and channeled into persevering through a difficult time. Instead of overthinking about it and ruminating on it, persevere through it. Be industrious, be resourceful, know when to retreat when that conflict would put you in danger or whenever it would be a waste of energy. So your flight response is just down from your fight response. And that's because you need this flight of the mobilization combined with shutdown to create freeze. So it is a little bit closer, but they are basically the same nervous system response. So freeze is also your immobilization response. It's commonly but inaccurately called freeze. It's an activation of the dorsal vagal branch of the nervous system. And this is when the nervous system has determined that fight and flight have not worked to achieve safety. So it protects you through energy conservation. And freeze occurs on a spectrum. So this is the spectrum. If you were to imagine this arrow being turned vertically, this is going towards the top of the ladder. So fight and flight are that way. And then this is kind of a progression of going from freeze into shutdown. So it does occur on a spectrum. It's not as clear as fight and flight. Also why it can be so tricky. So anything from feeling helpless to numb, to dissociating, to shutting down, to fainting or dying. If you've ever fainted, you've been in a full shutdown response. All right, so the emotions of freeze also happen on a spectrum. So it can be anything from boredom and numbness to apathy to shame to complete hopelessness. Sensations in the heart or sensations in the body that you'll feel as the brakes are pushed on your body is your heart rate will slow down. You may feel like you can't think or speak. You may feel like you don't have access to your words. Maybe you have a lot of brain fog. Maybe you're feeling depressed, weakness or heaviness in your body, feeling even detached from your body or dissociated from your body whenever it's really severe. And then when you don't meet that immobilization with awareness, that's when you find yourself unable to make decisions. You're scrolling and zoning out. You can't get out of bed. You're isolating yourself. You're shaming yourself for all of these things. And then you're just like giving up and letting it all go to hell because it doesn't matter because you can't do anything about it because you feel helpless. All right. When immobilization is integrated, meaning we know how to catch it and meet it with awareness, this is where we feel mindfulness, peace and calm, presence. We can be alone without being lonely. We have access to stillness and meditation. We can be judicious. We can have discernment and we can pause to consider our options. The nervous system is slowing us down. What a gift, right? Slowing us down so we can have discernment and pause to consider all of our options. When it's unintegrated, we are going to feel extreme anxiety, like panic, isolating ourselves, withdrawing, maybe being like a couch potato, being unmotivated, but feeling guilt or shame for not having motivation, believing that you're a failure, afraid of achieving things, zoning out, scrolling, and procrastinating. Again, all on a spectrum. You may have a variety of those things, and that's totally fine. So as we go into immobilization, this is freeze and then shut down. That is where our fawn response happens. So fawning is not actually a nervous system state. It's not on the polyvagal ladder as a physiological state in the body, but there is often a high level of nervous system activation in someone who fawns. Fawning is a behavioral modification in reaction to a nervous system state. And you are more likely to fawn when you are in freeze or shutdown because you don't have access to these resources here that give you the ability to assert yourself and set boundaries or get the fuck out. So you're more likely to fawn when you're here. So fawn response emotions, again, can be all over the place. You can feel unworthy, unloved, resentful, depleted, anxious, like you want to hide or blend in, or you don't know what the fuck you feel because you're always focused on everyone else. Sensations in your body. This is where we start getting a lot of those like really sticky sensations, like knots in your throat and sick to your stomach and anxiety, feeling physically or emotionally drained, or maybe you're totally distracted from that sensation because you're not connected to your body. And when we don't meet that with awareness, that's when we're people pleasing, we're in codependency patterns, we're ignoring our own needs, not setting boundaries. We care too much for other people, often at the expense of our own wellness. We overgive, often at the expense of our own wellness. We don't say no, we flatter other people, or we deny or avoid conflict. Believe it or not, there is an integrated fawn response. So this looks like service, compromise, peacemaking, caretaking. There's a lot of integrated fawning in parenting because you're constantly meeting the needs of someone else and not yourself. Fairness, listening, and meeting the attachment needs of children, right? That requires the parent to often set aside their own needs to meet the needs of their children. That is a fawn response and it is required. When unintegrated though, it's that over-serving, over-giving, people-pleasing, you can kind of become a doormat, groveling, feeling like social perfectionism or social anxiety. You say yes, but you really mean no, you lose yourself. You're not outwardly expressing anger, but inwardly you're just resentful of other people. And fawning is really self-abandonment. You're abandoning yourself to avoid being abandoned or to please others. So if your nervous system goes into a sympathetic fight flight mobilization when you're triggered, you are going to experience the same increased heart rate, quick shallow breathing, muscle tension, dry mouth, sweating, and flushing as you would experience if you came face to face with a bear in the woods. Physiologically, the body and the nervous system don't know the difference. If you don't meet that fight response with awareness, you will unconsciously react. We've all done this by yelling at others, getting defensive, hurting someone out of anger, arguing with strangers on the internet, right? Lots of unintegrated fight responses on the internet, and blaming or shaming others. If we don't meet that flight response with awareness, we can panic, avoid people and places or potential triggers, overthink, fawn, quit, try to be more perfect, you know, racing around, like that's that unintegrated flight response. If your nervous system goes into parasympathetic immobilization when you're triggered, you will experience the same loss of words, dissociation, stuckness, and shame as when you are overwhelmed with any experience in real time. Because again, physiologically, the nervous system and the body don't know the difference. So when you don't meet that immobilization with awareness, you can shame yourself, fawn, scroll, zone out, dissociate, give up. I'm not sure why it says hiding. It just should just say hiding, like hiding yourself, trying to camouflage, blend in, not stick out, not be seen. So more common trigger feelings that I don't want to associate with a nervous system response, because I do find sometimes people can get really hyperfixated on trying to identify the state of their nervous system. And that's not as important as identifying what you feel. If you can connect that to a nervous system state, great. If not, that's totally okay. But when we're triggered, we can often feel small, helpless, and hopeless. We may feel really intense shame, like wanting to run and never be seen again. We might feel fragile, on edge, or delicate. Major drop in confidence and self-esteem. We can get into that all or nothing binary thinking. That's always a sign that you're triggered about something. The inner critic just gets really fucking loud and won't shut up. Increased drasticizing or catastrophizing, or your emotional reaction is out of proportion to the trigger itself, right? It's like an inappropriate over the top response to something that's not that over the top. Feeling especially judgmental of others, when a minor upset feels like an emergency, when angering at and shaming yourself for hours or days, if you get stuck in those thought loops where you're just beating yourself up and you're angry and you're shaming yourself, self-disgust and self-hatred, unfairly exploiting on someone who's innocent, intensified self-criticism and self-shaming, only finding fault with yourself, or conversely, only finding fault with others. All right. Woo. I was hoping that break was coming soon. let's take a quick break. Let's do 5 minutes. So we'll come back at 43 after, and we'll finish up our workshop.